Butch McAdams, in and out of sports. And this show is sponsored in part by Horton's Funeral Service, Dr. Edward T. Buford, and the Athletic Republic Capital Region. And as always, In and Out of Sports in the Coach's Corner is powered by the African American Athlete.com and my super producer, the founder, the veteran sports writer out of Motown. He is Rick Hampton Sr. Well, folks, we have another great one visiting in the Coach's Corner. He is out of the DMV. Simply one of the best high school All-American, college All-American, spent so many years in the NBA and overseas, but more importantly, he is a structure. He is a pillar in the community and giving back, especially with youngsters. So without further ado, let's bring on my friend, Gerard Mustafa. Hey, big guy, how you doing?
Hey, Coach, how you doing? Great to be on your show today. And, Coach, let me tell you this, man. I was so impressed with you last week with that history lesson you gave all of us about basketball in District of Columbia and Prince George's County, you know, for that in the water. That was outstanding. And so if I could, Coach, I need to call upon you to, you know, to give me another lesson or two so I can learn more about our rich history of basketball in the DMV.
Well, I tell you what. I'll tell our listeners, and of course you're familiar with a little bit of history that wasn't so great.
Yes.
And I always tease them about it, but it's a true story. The great Morgan Wooten, arguably the greatest high school basketball coach of all time, didn't have many losses, did not have many losses. And my Ray squad, 1988, will never forget this, playing DeMatha and Gerard Mustafa, we're having the game of our lives. I'm talking about the game of our lives. Got a two-point lead with 3 seconds to go. The DeMatha player takes a shot, misses, hits the top of the rim, bounces high. Gerard jumps over everybody, tips it in, goes into overtime, and, of course, the rest was history. Man, why'd you do that, man?
Yes, sir.
If you were just a second late, you know what?
That's a testament to your outstanding coaching because, listen, we had, I thought, one of the best teams that year at DeMatha. I mean, we were playing a national schedule. We just got finished, I think, playing Kenny Anderson and Robert Werdan, you know, at Archbishop Molloy. You know, we were rolling, and so we thought that we were invincible. We get to Murray, and we just knew we were just going to walk over you guys.
Yeah.
Man, but you guys had a hell of a game plan, and that was just outstanding coaching and nothing we could do. We were just so lucky to get away with a win that game, and we were just lucky that game. Sometimes the ball bounces the right way, and my good friend Bobby Hill was there to put it in, help us win, and, you know, and that's history.
No question about that.
Shout out to
the coach Charles Lewis, and of course our big man, Big Ant Anthony Carr, and our point guard Sylvester Simpkins Jr. But let's go back to the documentary, and I understand that it's an hour production.
Mm-hmm.
You can't get everyone in. However, some omissions aren't acceptable. And I know it doesn't mean that much to you because of the type of individual that you are. But there's no way you can mention the dominance of Prince George's basketball without mentioning a Gerard Mustafa, because 10 years or more before Durant and Beasley and Oladipo, you were a first-round draft pick.
Yes, sir. Yeah, I mean, you know, Coach, you know, not, I received about 5-6 phone calls from people who were discussing it. You know, and I think that any time that you're giving your narrative, you know, you give your perspective. And I think for those young brothers, you know, that are coming up, you know, those are people who they probably – played with, played against, they know about. And obviously you have Lynn Bias, who's a legend by itself. You know, and so I understand that. So I understand you're going to miss people. You know, if you did a five-part or a six-part, you know, miniseries, then it changes things up. Now you have a chance to get everybody who's contributed to Prince George's County basketball. I think we talked about Thurl Bailey as being, you know, one of the great, you know, from Bladensburg High School and NC State, national championship, and played for Utah Jazz for many years. And so there are a lot of players, you know, that I think that, you know, probably should have been mentioned, you know, who paved the way for people like myself. You know, when I first came to DeMatha, I didn't know anything, I guess, moved to Maryland, Prince George's County, nothing about DeMatha, really. And my dad introduced me to it, but I was watching NC State play, and it was three players. It was Sidney Lowe, Derek Wittenberg, the DeMatha backcourt, and it was Thurl Bailey. They said, those three guys right there are legendary players. And I grew up in North Carolina as a kid, and so I watched them. I said, wow, they came from the same area that I'm moving to. You know, and so for me, you know, they had that legendary status. And, you know, going to DeMatha and being exposed to it, then, yeah, I think those guys, you know, of course, and being able to go to a college and beat the Goliath, you know, in Houston with Akeem Olajuwon, that was outstanding. So those guys, for me, should definitely be mentioned, you know, anytime you're talking about the greatness from Prince George's County.
Gerard Mustafa is in the Coach's Corner,
yes,
in and out of sports,
yes,
with
sir.
Coach Butch McAdams. And Gerard, let's talk about the origin of Gerard Mustafa, both as a young man and as a basketball player. I'm familiar with your very strong family foundation and structure of a family that emphasizes strong ethnic pride, education, and service. Share that foundation with our listeners.
Yeah. Well, I give credit to my father. You know, he passed 9 years ago. You know, my dad, he was the one, you know, in our family. And I would say in our family, I mean, in my entire look at our family lineage and our family tree, he was the one who traced his history back. You know, he did whatever it took. He said he went to the archives in Raleigh. He wanted to find out where did his family get the name from. How did, you know, just want to get his background. He put the work in, and, you know, he decided at some point in the late 60s to change his name. And he found out, he realized who he was as a person, and his character continued to evolve into the man that he became. And he wanted to, and so he infused all of that into me. And so I tried my best to live up to that. And, you know, making, you know, strong family, you know, commitment to your race, to your ethnicity, to your people, you know, trying to have, you know, community engagement, community involvement, you know, being sensitive to other people, you know, but loving yourself. And so everything that we have done, or I've done as an adult, has been, you know, with that thought in mind. And so, you know, I give all credit to him and what he's done, and I try to do my best to live up to his legacy and what he started. And, you know, and so just having strong people around me that when I slip and when I fall short, they push me, they encourage me, and say, remember, you're a Mustafa for a reason. You know, and so that helps me continue, you know, continue to build and to learn and to grow. And, you know, I mean, that's it. I mean, that's pretty much what it is.
Mm-hmm. At what point did you start playing the great game of basketball? And then at what point did you and others realize, hey, you know what? You've got some special gifts along with your size. You could go a long ways in this game.
That is a funny story. You will not believe so. So I grew up in a small town called Whiteville. I moved to Maryland. Well, my first time coming to Maryland was when I was 12. So lived with my mother and my stepfather. And my stepfather used to always say, man, you're going to be a superstar. So he had built this basketball court or goal behind the house, and it was like 12 feet high. And he would tell me he played, he averaged 30 points in high school, and he would shoot this high arcing shot. And, man, I was terrible. I really couldn't play. So guys come over the house, and I would never get picked in my own backyard, which is crazy. I would never even play. So, you know, they were always between 10, 11, 12. And so I started going to a neighbor's house, and they would beat me every day. They were older guys, but they would beat me. So I finally played for my, I guess, middle school team in seventh grade in Whiteville. Played down there, and I started. I actually started as small forward. I was about 6'1". I started, and we played a limited schedule. So that summer, I came to visit my dad and spent the summer with him. And he took me to Morgan Wooten's basketball camp. All right. That's when I first met my good friend Cedric Lewis at that camp. So me and Cedric was kind of like both kind of tall and gangly, and we kind of played together, not in the senior division, but on the intermediate division. So we played the lower level at camp. This was called Metropolitan Area Basketball School with Morgan Wooten and Coach Joe Gallagher.
Yeah.
Nothing special. We just went, we played, and you know, I did have interaction with Adrian Dantley, which I had no idea who he was. But Adrian Dantley had, for some reason, had called me down in front of 300 campers to demonstrate a move that he made, right? And I had no idea because I was in the stands kind of talking, and he embarrassed me in front of everybody. So I went back and sat down. And you know, AD is kind of straightforward, man.
Yep.
And so I went back and I was embarrassed. And from that point on, I went out to drills, and every drill that they gave us, I would go home, write them down, and I would make sure I would do them. So finally, the next year is when I came back to camp again. I came back up to Maryland, went to the camp again. And by this time, I was the best player in camp. Won everything, and Coach Wooten had the first day somebody gave me a note and said Coach Wooten wanted to talk to me. So I went inside, talked to Coach Wooten, said I'm in eighth grade. Where you going? You know what you're doing? I said I'm in eighth grade. I live in North Carolina. So we talked. He asked my dad to call him. So and that kind of started everything. And so when that happened, my dad explained exactly who went to DeMatha, who DeMatha was. So I watched Maryland play. I watched ACC basketball. Uh-huh. So I knew the NC State players. And now I saw Adrian Branch. I said, damn, Adrian Branch played there too? It was just so many players I started learning about. And so then I started to figure out, man, I can play. So I would beat everybody in my age bracket in Maryland. I was dunking. I was, you know, I was really playing above my age level. So I beat my dad. And my thing was, if I could beat my father because he was kicking my butt, then I was going to be a pretty good player, right?
That's right.
And so we had fun with that whole summer, and he'd never beat me since then. And he would take me to the court. We would work out. We would play. I actually lived in the gym. So just, you know, I guess from that moment on, I really started, you know, believing I could play. And we convinced my mother that I need to be in Maryland. And my mother agreed to let me come and stay. And I ended up playing for a team, CYO team, St. Mark's, which was like mini DeMatha to us because, you know, I played with my DeMatha teammates eventually. You know, Danny Ferry and all those guys that went there. And, you know, so I was a very dominant player in the CYO league. And I met Kurt Smith. I thought Kurt Smith was the baddest guard that I've ever seen.
No question.
He was a year younger than me. I'm telling you, in the seventh grade, I made sure I found out who this kid was. And, you know, he went behind the back with us in a game, and I'm like, wow. So that was Kurt Smith, you know, meeting. So anyway, we went undefeated, and we ended up losing the championship game by a point in the CYO championship. I spent half the game in foul trouble. I had four fouls, you know, but, you know, I think at that time, at that point, I realized that, you know what, I could do something in basketball. And I'll tell you one more thing. You know, by the time I was in, went to high school, and so I wanted to, the big thing was making varsity. They said, well, you have a chance to make varsity to math as a freshman. And at that point in time, I think Danny Furry was the fifth player to make varsity as a freshman. I think Drew Comlo was the fourth player to make it. And people were saying, no, you're pretty good, but you want to make varsity. So I was intent on making varsity as a ninth grader, and I did whatever it took. And I had people who would take me, who would train me, who would work me out. And I give this guy credit. You know, we argue all the time now, but his name is Mike Gillen. Mr. Gillen was the guy who picked me up when my dad took me to the gym. Mr. Gillen actually gave me, back then, you had to have a leather basketball. I never knew what a leather basketball was. I just got a ball from anywhere. So he actually gave me a leather basketball for indoor use, and I would lay in my bed at night just shooting up and just working and just envisioning myself just, you know, just making shots. So I had good people in my corner, and I have to also give, and, you know, my dad thought that, you know what, it's a suburban basketball, man. You know, you need to get to the city a little bit. Mm-hmm. So he took me down to number two Boys and Girls Club met Donald Hodge and all those guys, and so Mike Tate. And then I went down and I ended up meeting Oscar Phillips. And Oscar Phillips took me in, and we played the youth games. I reconnected with Kurt Smith and Cedric Lewis and Henry Hall. And, man, and we just went on a tear across, beat everybody. You know, playing with those guys, going down there, playing against Len Bias. At that point, you know, we were like 15, but, you know, Jay was on our team. So Lenny would come by and play with us. And then eventually, Hurl Bates, Fluff Potter, you know, these guys. Yeah. And so you had these basketball icons, I think, in the city who just always. And so we talk about godfathers of basketball. To me, those gentlemen are the godfathers of basketball in the DMV. And you have to give credit to Hurl Bates, Oscar Phillips, you know, these guys. And the young guy at that time for me was Coach Lou Wilson. And Lou was like, and he has won over 700 games, you know, in high school and still going strong. But he was like a baby back then. And Lou would even get on the floor with us and play with us. You know, and so we had so many good guys that just looked out for us and, you know, just helped us mature as basketball players and, you know, talk to us about life and all of those things. And we didn't have to want anything because they made sure we were okay. And they never asked for anything. You know, and so those guys were great guys, you know, helped push us, you know, put us in the right positions and allowed us to grow at a pace that we were able to accomplish our goals. And, you know, I remember the one thing that, you know, Bob Furry, Danny Furry's dad told my dad at the time. He said, he said, I would take Danny down and drop him off at Hines. We would leave Annapolis or Bowie, and I'd drop him off at Hines, you know, junior high, so he can bang with those players down there, because he wanted him to get comfortable playing with city guys too, as well as playing, you know, with the conventional, traditional DeMatha style basketball. And so it helped. And I think anybody who is trying to develop that into a great player, you know, you got to have that city swag, that city energy, that style of basketball in you. And so, you know, we were just, you know, very grateful for that.
No question.
Yeah.
We continue our conversation in the locker room, in the coach's corner. In and Out of Sports with Gerard Mustafa. And Gerard, a couple of interviews ago, I had Coach Bob Wade on from Baltimore Dunbar. And then week I had Muggsy Bogues on. And they both talked about Dunbar poet pride. It's just something special that when you put that jersey on, you can feel the difference. The same thing can be said about DeMatha. Talk about the DeMatha aura and DeMatha pride.
Yes, sir. So that first week that I met Coach Wooten, he gave me a book, and the book was called From Orphans to Champions. And the story of DeMatha is more than Wooten, and it talked about the history of DeMatha. And once you read that book, once I read that book, and it detailed the commitment, it talks about, you know, God, family, school, and basketball, no more than the fourth. You talk about those things. You hear from, Coach John Wooden, from Red Auerbach, and everyone's talking about, the DeMatha philosophy and what it means. That stuck with me, and I wanted to be a part of that tradition of winning, of excellence. And, and so when you put that jersey on, it kind of makes you – you feel like you are a winner already. You know, you want to build winners, I think, and everybody wants to be a winner in life and something. But when you actually earn that jersey and you put that jersey on, you feel invincible. You feel that every time you step into a basketball court, oh, yeah, we got this. Yeah, we got this, you know. And you want to live up to that standard. And it's not just about you and your 12 or 15 teammates. It's about the hundreds of men, scholars that came before you, that you're representing them too. And you want to do such a good job, because I'm thinking that, man, all of them guys are watching me. You know, I'm thinking that everybody who's come through, who's done anything, is like, think about, well, man, what's DeMatha doing now? Because I know now, as an older gentleman, I'm doing the same thing. I'm thinking about what's Hunter Dixon done and what's Earl, and I'm thinking about, are they carrying the tradition? Are they living up to the standard that we have been a part of? You know, and so that, I think, separates positive separation. But the other thing is just being a part of a, what they call now One DeMatha, is a family, is that you're bonded for life. You know, no matter what, I think that you're bonded with your teammates and people who have graduated from DeMatha, you know, for life. And you will find if you turn on, like, for about 2 week period, actually before the pandemic started, I was looking at the NFL, the pre-draft. It was talking about, DeMatha players, going to the draft. You know, all you hear about is, the Redskins, who are they going to draft? You know, I look and you got JB, James Brown.
That's right.
You're looking at, you got the Lakers and you got Quinn Cook. And then you have Oladipo on the Voice or the Masked Singer. It's like every time I turn the television on, there's a DeMatha representation. And so just to being a part of something that's that great, you feel it. I mean, it makes you feel that you are different. And it it's not just a 10-year period or a 20-year period. So when I look at Mount Verde and IMG, yeah, they're good now. Nah, but they're not. They didn't set the standard for 50, 60 years. You know, that's been excellent in everything. And so I just don't think there's anything, there's a school out there that is impressive to me as DeMatha is, and want to be a part of that. I love Dunbar, Baltimore. I absolutely love Coach Wade and what he meant for me and for the year I was with him, because it changed my perspective and my family perspective of college athletics completely. And I still infrequently speak to Coach Wade and just check on him and see how he's doing. But yes, I love Dunbar. you know, but that standard was there. And I think to some degree it came, you had it with, you know, I think when you look back, I think Sam Cassell played in my era, but also we played against Dunbar and he played for Coach Wade. And then I think the next we probably had that I remember was Keith Booth afterwards came in as part of the Dunbar. But as far as the tradition continuing to today, Dunbar kind of fell off in the city in terms of continuity. They fallen off some.
Gerard Mustaf is in the coach's corner. And, Gerard, expound briefly for our listeners on Morgan Wooten. You talk about the DeMatha way. You talk about the DeMatha culture. But the person who started it off was Morgan Wooten, a very special man. Talk about Coach Wooten, and can you share with us your most memorable Morgan Wooten story?
You know, I had a chance to spend a lot of time with Coach Wooten. You know, I started, you know, it's kind of funny, Coach Wooten, that we thought that we were making some money. I tell guys, I still got my receipt for Coach Wooten, my pay stubs from back when we were at his basketball camp. I made about $60 a week.
But
oh,
you were
man.
Playing hoops, you know, though. You were playing
hoops.
I know.
But see, I didn't realize that. So, and that's why life comes at you at different times. You see things differently. So I was telling my son now, I said, listen, you want to go to camp and work because now you're learning those valuable life skills, how to communicate. You know, you're seeing basketball from a different perspective. You know, you're teaching, you're showing kids drills. You know, it's things that we didn't even look at. But I said, man, the brilliance of Coach Wooten. He had me, he said, listen, after my eighth grade year when I was actually the best player at this camp, and now I'm going in and coaching. So it was interesting that I've coached like Kevin McClinton. I played in college with Kevin McClinton, but I was actually a camp counselor, and he was one of my college teammates, you know. But when you're looking at it, Coach Wooten said, okay, now you're going to be a camp counselor. I'm going to let you come in and you're going to coach the juniors, the young kids, too, but you're also going to be my demonstrator. I'm going to take you with me. And so actually for 3 years, I was his official demonstrator for camp. And every session that he had to demonstrate any drill, he had me do it. So now Coach Wooten must have known this because I wasn't going to embarrass him nor myself. So I would go and make sure that I worked at home on those drills that I knew I had to do.
Mm-hmm.
So we wouldn't look bad and I could not mess up. So, and he didn't have to say nothing. It was just like Coach Wooten had an aura about him that you just knew how and what to do around him. Then he would bring in people and say, okay, well, when you're shaking hands and meeting a coach, how are you supposed to do that? And he would demonstrate the incorrect way, the correct way. Then he would take me on a road with him and we would travel. And he had a way of making you feel so comfortable. So here I am as a 16-year-old, you know, African-American, you know, teenager that's about 6'9", with older white gentlemen. And he would have maybe one or two of his friends, whether it's Coach Massimino or Bill Noble or someone else. We would be sitting eating down at the restaurant. And he would not let me sit anywhere else. I would sit right with them. You know, he was just made me feel so comfortable at ease that I was amazed that he had a gift like that he would just do that. And I remember one time I was at camp at Mason-Dixon. We were up in at Emmitsburg at Mount St. Mary's.
Yes.
And the coaches at night would go down to part of the dorm and down the stairs, and they would have pizza and sit down and drink beer and all that. I didn't know they drank beer. Man, the day I found out Coach Wooten drank beer, man, I was like, oh, my goodness, because you just didn't expect that. And then I came to find out, oh, that's normal. All coaches sit down and drink beer at night. You know, they would eat pizza. You know, that pizza brought in, they were sitting, they drink beer and stuff. And I was
Lito's was the official meeting place.
Huh? Yeah, at least Lito's was the spot that we all, that Lito's was it. Every Friday went to Lito's. So that's been a DeMaster tradition that started by Coach Wooten and his guys. But, you know, he was just that type of guy. He was, and he had a quote for everything. I've never met a man who gave you a quote for every situation, a walking quote. And I've been using a few of his quotes my entire life. Every time I would speak, I remember my first time having a speaking engagement at his camp. And I came back to the coach. I said, Coach, how'd you like it? He said, perfect. Don't change anything.
Give us a couple of those quotes.
Probably my favorite is good, better, best. Never let them rest until the good gets better and the better becomes best. That's been my all-time favorite quote. You know, he had one, I cried because I had no shoes.
That's right.
Until I met a man that had no class.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
Inch by inch, life's a cinch. Yard by yard, life is hard. He just had these simple, these quotes that just like, wow, just made you think. And he was just brilliant
yes.
with it.
Yes, he was. And my favorite Coach Wooten quote that I use, and I still use it, is that they don't care how much you know until they know how much you care.
Yes.
Did you ever hear that one?
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
That was good.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
All right, now you are an All-American. You're one of the top players in the nation. I'm certain you had hundreds of scholarship offers, but you select Maryland. But as we talked prior to the interview, I want you to share this with the listeners. Let's go back to the beginning of the interview, and you talked about your father. You talked about the foundation in terms of loving self and kind. You had Howard on your short list.
Yes,
and
sir.
For one of the top five-star players in the country at that time, and even now, to have a historically black college or university on his short list, that was huge.
Right.
Talk about that.
Yeah, I think my dad was non-conventional. He was, you know, not traditional at all with the way that he thought, the way he processed things, and you know, we were sitting, we were watching, you know, he loved Irv Cross for some reason. You know, I was like the only black that we saw. He loved Irv Cross. That was on, I think, CBS at the time as a
right.
color analyst.
Mm-hmm.
And he also, I think he loved John Thompson because of the fact that he was the black coach that was beating everybody, was winning. And what he had to endure with the oppressive system that was in place, particularly when Patrick Ewing got there and all the things that he had to endure, you know, at Georgetown and in the Big East. So he made me understand that. So at that point, I was a North Carolina Tar Heel. I was a Dean Smith, North Carolina Tar Heel, James Worthy, Michael Jordan. That was it. That's what I grew up on, that Carolina blue. That was it. My dad saw things differently in 82 on, and he was trying to, I guess, change my mind about and really explain to me why he thought the way he thought. And Jesse Hams was his number one punching bag. That was a sore spot for him. And my dad was, to me, he was, people called him radical, but I think that he believed in what he believed in, And he always said he's just very conscious. And he wanted to raise my consciousness along with everyone else's consciousness to make them consider and think about people who don't look like them, or in our case, ourselves. You know, and so as, you know, when it came down to my recruitment and, you know, my dad wanted to control the recruitment, he didn't think that coaches should, because he watched the horror stories and people manipulate players and
sure.
go back and forth, you know, you get phone calls, and he said, nah, we don't get any phone calls. You know, he met with Coach Wooten and told Coach Wooten what they expected. You know, I started getting recruiting letters very early. And I think part of the reason why, because I was doing a demonstration for Coach Wooten. Also, he did an annual coaches clinic, and all the who's who would always be there.
That's
and
right.
as a, you know, as a promising prospect, of course, they wanted to start. And it didn't hurt the fact that I was with Danny Ferry and Steve Hood and, you know, and all the other players at the Mather too. So, so all that attention started to come, and so he wanted to get ahead of it. And I think that once he realized that, man, I'm going to be one of the top players in my class, that we have a platform. Now, how we use that platform is on us. You know, one of his heroes was Muhammad Ali. You know, he just talked about him, Jim Brown, and, you know, and my dad never had a chance to go to college and play basketball or anything. He didn't have that. Didn't even have football teams or didn't have much of anything in his all-black high school that he attended. So, you know, he looked at an opportunity and said, man, you could do probably more for your race in the sporting world than anything else. And he said, let's see if we could, you know, and he didn't like the fact that the black schools were overlooked, that players were never really considering them after integration. You know, after, you know, integration came and players started going to Alabama's and
sure.
North Carolina, and they got Charlie Scott in the late 60s and all these things happened. He said, wow, what can we do? So Howard was the school because it was – we call the Mecca, right? So Howard, the Mecca, is right here.
Correct.
And my dad happened to, not sure how he met him, but so my dad worked in D.C. He was a bus driver and he was a union representative for Greyhound Lines, you know, for a while before he became a bailiff. And so he had a lot of relationships with people in the city. And so John Thompson, he knew A.D. Williamson, and through conversation with them, with the coaches, it came up. And then I think AB was recruiting a few players on my AAU team at the time, which was Executive 3, which was ran again by Mr. Bates.
Yeah.
And Coach Lou Wilson was the coach. Now, it didn't hurt that Coach Lou end up becoming an assistant for AB too. Let me say that. So it didn't hurt.
Okay. All right. Didn't know about that connection.
Yeah. That's kind of, that's how it works. So Lou was kind of, you know, hey, recruit me a little bit too. So I said, you know what, man? We said, look, we wanted to make sure we include HBCU on my final list of schools. No matter what, and Howard was that school. I had, you know, and I narrowed my schools down. I have to get 8 earlier because I just wanted to cut down on a lot of places. The only places I wanted to think about, the ones that I was considering. And then I narrowed it down to 3, which was Howard, Maryland, and Georgia Tech. I went to Atlanta, and if you knew anything about Atlanta back in the day, I fell in love with Atlanta.
Yeah.
As a city too, and I had some family there.
And let me say this, Gerard, for maybe our listeners, there was a connection there because there was the DeMatha guy probably recruiting you my good friend Perry Clark.
Perry Clark, you know Perry
yeah.
Clark.
So
Clark
it's always a connection,
but
folks.
No, hey, listen, you actually had two. You had the master. So, you know, you had Hype was there also.
Okay.
I was a DeMatha player, and he was the director of, I think, player development. I forgot what his title was, but he was there. So we had two DeMatha guys there. So, yeah, Perry was there recruiting me. But the one coach that I really liked was Bobby Cremins.
Yeah.
Bobby Cremins and me connected. We connected early. Matter of fact, he started eighth grade recruiting me. And so this is where it works. And I don't know if people realize that. So eighth grade, after the eighth grade in that summer going to DeMatha, he sent me my first letter, handwritten letter, Bobby Cremins did. And so we started that relationship at that point. And he made it all the way to the end. And one of the things that kind of, you know, hurt me going to Georgia Tech, he had like three ACC players of the year on his team at my time.
Yeah.
And Dennis Scott was scoring 27 points a game. So I'm like, well, I'm not getting the ball. Tom Hammonds was scoring 20 points a game. And that means I was going to play center. And so I said, that ain't going to work. But that's what was going on at Georgia Tech, you know, at that time. But I think that sometimes coaches don't – well, I think they do, but not all of them. Relationship, when you start building early, and I'm looking at – I just saw Ja Morant said the same thing about his coach when he went to – yeah, he had other offers, but they started early. They came early, and it happened. And so that's why, you know, when those things happen, you know, you build a trust factor, I think, and you build a relationship with people, and you want to, and you keep it going. And so they put the work in for me, and so it got down to the end. My uncle was living in Atlanta at the time. I liked the city. It was progressive. It had a black mayor. I mean, it was the mini D.C. It was the D.C. of the South.
That's
so
right.
ACC, all those things that had going for it. You know, so – but Bob Wade, and, you know, Bob Wade had – we had a black chancellor. We had Mr. Slaughter was our chancellor. We actually sat down, we talked, and, you know, we had some things going. A.B. was doing his best job that he could at Howard. But, you know, at that point, Howard couldn't compete with Maryland nor Georgia Tech at the end.
Yeah. And the ACC – talk
right.
about what was it like you select the University of Maryland just a stone's throw from DeMatha.
Mm-hmm.
So you're still at home. And but you're going to College Park post Lynn Bias. Talk about that. And then, you know, as you alluded to, Bob Wade is just a great, great, great man. Tremendous coach, but a better man who cares about his players. Talk about that year or two playing for Coach Wade.
Well, first, let me just backtrack on this Lynn Bias tragedy. So I started in the eighth grade. I started so Lefty was also recruiting me early, and Lefty gave me free reign of the gym, the practice gym, whatever I needed at Maryland, throughout my ninth grade, 10th grade year. I would go up there and I would play with the players. I would take the bus from DeMatha, get off at College Park, stay there, play, hang out, leave, and get the bus to Greenbelt. Everything was like 3 miles, 3 miles from, yeah, really 2 to 3 miles. Into my 10th grade year that summer, I was at camp when we got word that, that Lena died. And, of course, that year, a lot of turmoil. But my close friend and teammate, Steve Hood, had committed, and he was going to go to Maryland. He was committed. He was signed by Lefty, you know, but, you know, he ended up going to Maryland. So I was up there a lot that year. So it was different, very different. The culture of the team and everything about the university to me had changed. And I watched them practice. I mean, they went through a losing spell for a while that year. They had a lot of freshmen playing. You know, you had, I remember John Johnson and Teon McCoy and Dave Dickerson, Steve Hood, you know, so, and some guys sat out. There's a lot of stuff going on that one year, I think. By his second year, Brian Williams came in. You got Rudy Archer from Baltimore.
Yeah.
You know, so now they're starting to pick it up. And, all right, now the energy is getting back into the building. They're competing. They're making it, you know, the NCAA again. So it was looking very promising. And, you know, so I spent a lot of time watching practice and just, you know, being around that. I'd only met Coach Wade initially. We had played them when I was in high school when he was still at Dunbar. So I knew who he was and I met him. But now I was seeing the practice. And then, of course, him and his staff started recruiting me too. And, you know, I had, like I said, I had friends on the team, and so I would spend time there. I think Coach Wade did a great job in terms of really caring about the players, and I witnessed this firsthand.
Yeah.
And I am a defender 100% of Coach Wade. I don't care what anybody say about it. This man loved his players. He fought for them. And if anybody have any doubt of what he stood for, you go back to Dunbar and you can talk about everything that he did in the city of Baltimore and how he changed the lives of all those players that came through Dunbar. He didn't change it in Maryland. Now, I thought one of the strangest things I've ever seen, and I'm a young guy. I don't know at that point. Didn't know much about this whole world. But if you knew how Cold Fieldhouse was built, you knew where the basketball offices were, right? On the corner, in one corner. Well, when I ended up one day was hanging out up there, I walked around to the opposite end. Whose office do you think was there? Lefty Driesell. So Lefty called me in the office. We went in there, sit down. I said, Coach, what you doing here? Oh, they gave me some job to do this fundraising and this. I'm just here. I'm like, wow. You know, I won't go into detail about conversation, but
sure.
The fact that the predecessor and the beloved Lefty Driesell, who was forced out, sharing the same building, the same space, the same everything as the coach there now, plus the fact that and I really like Coach Ron Bradley. He was the leftover from Lefty, but he was also forced to be a part of Coach Wade's staff. And if you know how everything went down, then you understand kind of what happened to Coach Wade, that everybody was kind of waiting. Now, I think, you know, and the money of the sports come in is the economics is, your boosters, what they want. And at that point in time, University of Maryland was not ready for a black coach. Bottom line, we saw it. We saw it from day one. We saw David Sell, Washington Post, every article that he wrote, what it was about.
That's right.
And so when I got there, Coach Wade was so smart with it, my roommates that year were going to be who? Rudy Archer and Teon McCoy. Yeah, but Rudy got put out. Teon ended up sitting out. And so it became me and Walt Williams, you know, in this for a while in the suite. But I would see Rudy, and I would see how they would try to get him to the community college. so he can take courses. I just never in my right mind could figure out you have a young black man from the inner city of Baltimore who is trying to better himself, who is trying to go to college. For whatever reason, he didn't make the academics. So the coach had found a way to get him into a junior college. He did not have a ride there. So they made sure he had a ride to the college, and that became an issue. I do not understand that at all. And so for me, when they say the control that Coach Wade had, the lack of control that he had in the institution, I thought he should be given an award for that. Anytime a coach is trying to get his student-athletes eligible, not just for basketball, for an opportunity to go to college and to graduate and to do things that you told his mother and father you would help him for, help him out with. And so when that situation came, you know, we lost the young man. You know, they lost, Rudy lost that whole opportunity. And Coach Wade ended up losing, you know, his coaching career. Other folks that was also on the staff lost their coaching career that I didn't think was fair at all. And then a couple of years later, Coach Giselle, you know, he's back, he's coaching. You know, he's coaching at down in Virginia, James Madison. He goes to James Madison, he wins down there, then he goes and he coaches, and he's in the Hall of Fame now.
Yeah,
he goes to Georgia State. You know, not to take anything away from Coach, you know, from Coach Lefty, because I love Coach Lefty Giselle as well. He's a great guy. But when you look at those situations and you don't see the inequity in it, there's a problem. And so my dad made sure that I could recognize those things as they happen. And the point I want to make, Coach, to the audience is that, and I think that we lump athletes, black, white, together because we play sports. If you're on a team, the sports being on a part of a team supposed to erase the color, or like, you know, there's no color because one team. No, not even, that's not even close to being the case. So, case in point, my parents, it was the first time that when Coach Wade was a coach, they actually could go to dinner. They actually can do what grown folks do. They're in the same age bracket. They're the same age. They wanted to go out and, you know, and do what grown folks do, have a little drink or a good time or entertain each other, play cards or whatever we do as a culture. They were able to do that and communicate in a way that they all understood with the Wade family, you know, with Coach Woody was there with them. They could do that thing and enjoy and have a great time. Matter of fact, they might like macaroni and cheese and potato salad and all. They have a commonality with our parents. When Coach Williams came, nothing at all. There's nothing there. It was like they're strangers. Hello, sir. How you doing? Good to see you. Yeah, it was it. There's nothing else there. And so we missed that. And when you get older, you start to see the interaction between families, you know, white players and their families as opposed to white coaches. There's such a big difference, and that's why it's important sometimes, you know, for you to find a situation that you're comfortable, that your family, there's a family environment that's there too. You have to have that. We miss out on those things. Collectively around the country, we miss out when we send our child to somewhere else. And so I think that that's one of the things for me that stood out. And I just enjoyed the fact that, you know what, a couple things that came up, and it was a family matters. Coach Wade said, man, come on, Jim, why don't you talk about we're closer than that? Why don't you, you know, we're talking like, you know, that's how we communicate. I couldn't have that same communication with, you know, with most coaches. I mean, some you can, and I'll tell you one that I'm going to tell you one guy who you can't do that with, and that's Coach Mike Bray from DeMaster. Coach Mike Bray to me is that type of guy. He has never changed since he was at DeMaster. I spent some time with him this past year when he recruited some guys, but he is that guy that you can do that with. So all coaches you can't do that with. And I do give some white guys credit, but yes. And I think that by him being a basketball player that wanted to get to know all of his teammates and their families and their players allowed him to grow into that type of coach that would do the same stuff. But for the most part, we miss that. Our families miss out on that part of it.
Wow. And, of course, Mike Bray is the head men's basketball coach at Notre Dame. Let me ask you this, and you hit on it, and just want to get a quick response.
Okay.
When you have a platform, as you said, that your dad told you, he said, we have a platform, and our platform is athletics. Do you feel that in America, with so much going on a day-to-day basis, that these black superstars, the LeBron James, the Kevin Durant, the the Steph Currys, on and on and on, have an obligation to speak out and use that platform? Or some people will say, well, it's not for everyone. Some people just want to play ball, and others have the foundation and the initiative to speak out. What are your thoughts?
That's a tough question, because I think for different people, it's a different response. And case in point, Michael Jordan, and I know he's been criticized a lot, but I do understand his position of why he didn't do a lot, because it can be detrimental to your bottom line if that's what you're here for. Everyone is not built for that. So I think that when I was 17, we sat down and my dad, we had a serious conversation. He said, listen, this is what you can do. You want to do it? I said, yeah. He said, are you sure? He said, this is what's going to happen. He said, they're going to come for you. He said, it's going to be tough. Can you handle this? And so at that time, we had Dr. Alvin Thornton, you know, who came over and interviewed me, sat down and talked to me, and we got finished. Said, yeah, I think he can handle it. But everything that's going to come to you, I don't think that everyone is not built to handle it. And that's the tough part. Do you want to risk losing what you work for? And that is a price that everyone may not want to pay. And so there you go. But once you get to the point where you're making, I think, 30, 40 million a year, these guys are now, I think they have an obligation to their communities, to be more vocal. People spend a lot of money, a lot of time. They're heavily influencers to the community, that their obligation extends beyond the basketball court or playing fields. And how they do that, I don't know. I would like to see them address more issues. I would like to see them, the young man George Floyd that died in Minnesota. I would like to see the prominent players from Minnesota Timberwolves who they can't cut, who they can't do anything, who's guaranteed to stand up and say, I'm not going to play, I'm not going to do until something happens. I would like to see those guys. But is that guy, is the young guy, is Cat that guy? Is he is he that guy? I don't know if he is or not.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of notoriety, in terms of financial security, he could be, he's that guy. But does he have a strong enough network around him that's going to support him if he take that position? You see, we can't leave them guys hanging. We can't say, yeah, we want you to go out and do that, but damn, we're going to act like we don't know you when stuff hits the fan.
You know,
you
that,
know what I mean?
Hold it right there, Gerard. I've been saying that for so many years, in that we want people to take a stand, but we don't provide that safety net for them. Case in point,
mm-hmm.
years ago, when Arsenio Hall had his primetime nightly talk show, and folks said, don't you dare interview Minister Farrakhan. He interviewed Minister Farrakhan. Now, there were consequences, but were we there to catch him? And that is a very important point, man.
That is it. We are not. And we have to build that trust amongst each other that we have that for you. We're going to support you. And when we do that, yes, then we could do those things. You know, then. So I had a public debate about, I think, Mike Tomlin earlier. And I just thought that Mike Tomlin had put enough, he had enough skin in the game that he could have bring in Colin Kaepernick, especially when they went through 1, 2, 3 quarterbacks. I said, of all teams, he's a Super Bowl winning quarterback. I mean, coach, he's won a lot of games. He's tenured. You know, he's visible. He's all this. He's at the point, I thought, that if Colin Kaepernick was going to go play in the NFL again, they should bring him in. You'd have went through 3 or 4 quarterbacks. So that was my argument. And then some people say, hey, man, he can't do that. He don't control nothing either. And so if we always take that position, when will we ever move the needle and demand anything? We're not going to get anything until someone decides to sacrifice. And when they do sacrifice, that means we're going to have to be there to support them, pick them up. I mean, so we're not doing our job collectively as a culture when we don't do these things. And you slowly seeing people like, I can't think of the brother's name who has the studio in outside of Atlanta, Georgia. He's
Tyler Perry.
People like Tyler Perry, people who have in studios that can actually, you know what, if you don't have a job, if Monique can't get in, I got you, Monique. We have a situation for you that you can continue with your livelihood and your gift, your God-given gift. We can continue here. We have to build those things. When we get a job as a general manager of a franchise, an NBA, we say, okay, well, we can bring this guy in. Well, when you have a player like Johnny Manziel.
Mm-hmm.
He might get 3 or 4 chances, right?
Yeah.
I'm seeing Ryan Leaf. How many chances did Ryan Leaf get?
Yeah.
In the NFL? See, they will give them. What do? We get the general manager job and the president of basketball operations, and we sit there like we can't touch nobody. That somebody had not in cell, don't touch him. So what value is it for us to be in these positions?
Wow,
this is what I do personally. So personally, coach, this is what I do. So I'm nobody. I'm nobody. I'm just a man who do what I can. I don't have multiple revenue streams coming in. I just, for whatever I do have, if I have influence, if I have the ability to connect you with somebody that's going to help you out, I will make that phone call for you. I will do that because I believe that, hey, God gave me whatever gift that he gave me. He positioned me here. Whatever I have, if it's calling a college coach or NBA team, high school, whatever it is, I'll make that phone call for you and look out for people. Now, it doesn't do me any good if I have friends around in all these different positions and I can't call my friend. Well, I ain't going to call him because I know everybody calling him. What's the point of having a friend that I'm thankful that's got a job with, you know, with Nike or with whomever else if I can't get a favor from my friend? That don't make sense to me. When you have a friend, let me be able to use that. That's what it's for. When you have somebody, you better make that phone call. Use that friend because that's what that friend is there for. They're there to support their friends. And if we all did the same thing, we'll make such a big difference, man. It'd be such a big difference if we could all say the same thing. But unfortunately, we're not at that point. And one reason is because who's teaching us? Who's teaching us the values that we need to move us ahead? Nobody. Not us. And anything that we want to implement into the curriculum is taken out. We don't have our own schools. So I give credit to the Catholic schools because they have done a tremendous job of educating people, everybody. But it's their system of education, and they make sure they add, if you want to go to the math or whoever, you're going to take religion. You're going to take your core courses, but you're also going to get this. So we're going to make sure that your education is controlled to a certain extent, no matter what it is. Now, as a parent, if you don't either counter that or you add to that or you allow your child to understand what's going on, you know, then you're doing a disservice to them as well. So we have to be more actively involved in all this stuff that we're not. So we can't wonder, well, why this guy didn't why you have 10, 15 players from the NBA from Prince George's County, and there is no multi-court facility for basketball development in Prince George's County for us. You go figure that out. Can somebody? No. Who teaches these brothers that? Who?
Yeah.
You got guys walking around with $500 million contracts, and what do we have here for our young kids? What do we have for them besides a movie? Or I mean, what do we have? What are we giving them that
will
allow
the
next generation?
Facility? What about that facility?
Which one?
KD just built funded a huge facility, athletic facility, recreational facility in Prince George's County. I've not been there. I've heard about it. But I wanted to get your thoughts on that.
I haven't seen the way you described it, I haven't seen it. So that the way you described it, I haven't seen it.
All right,
Is there a facility with his name on it? Yes.
Okay.
There is something with the best facility in Prince George's County right now. If you take away the Athletic Republic, is probably the First Baptist Church of Glen Arden. They have a 3-court facility. Mm-hmm. Now, I've been around the country, and I still to this day do not understand why we do not have. If it's in the water, or if this is not this talk about in the water, but if this is the ground zero for potential NBA players or Division I basketball players, why do not we have a 10, 15, whatever court facility with all kind of extra amenities on it with computer lab and all the other things associated with it, why we can't develop that here, right, in Prince George's County for these kids and add a curriculum, rigorous curriculum, whether it's college prep, whether it's NCAA clearinghouse approved, all the things that we need right here. See, if we thought differently, we would have these things. And we're not going to think differently because who's teaching us? And for the most part, a lot of these guys may have been to 4 high schools, may have went 1 year in college, may have done one semester actually in college. And so where do they get this from? Who's mentoring, molding, teaching them things to give back to the community? Now, they're going to grow and learn as men in the world, right? They'll go and get that. But in terms of how do you get to understand that you're a black man, and in a black man you have a responsibility, and the way you build an infrastructure in your community is probably a little bit different. Where do we get that? If your father, your mother, your grandfather, the people who should be the ones who your first teachers don't have that information to give to you, your school, multiple schools aren't giving it to you, so you're not going to get that. And that's what's missing from us. That is
wow.
The definite thing. We could do so much more here for the next generation. And I wish we would, and I hope it's not too late. I hope that some guys get the message. I hope some of these older guys can pull guys in who have their ear and say, listen, man, let's try to do this. This here can help do this. And, you know, I love Kobe Bryant, right, for a lot of reasons. But I absolutely love LeBron James. And it has less to do with basketball than anything else. See what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Kobe is a player. I love him. And LeBron as a man, he is a man without a father, without any of that. I mean, how did he do what he did without having that infrastructure? The guy is a gifted brother, and he is doing tremendous things. And just for the fact that he's taking his friends, how many of us become millionaires at 18 like that and be able to figure out a way to take his best friends, his core friends, and let them operate in their own lane and become millionaires themselves? How
yeah.
many do we know that's doing that? None but him.
And
this guy is, yeah.
Gerard, I respect him because he doesn't allow the media or anyone to address those individuals as his quote-unquote posse. He said, no, they're not my posse. These are my business associates. These guys or people are part of my structure.
Yes, yes. That's what I'm talking about. Guys like that, he's doing it. In Akron and wherever, we need people who can watch LeBron James. I have a book I read last year, LeBron Inc., and it was revealing in terms of how his guys decided to, you know what, LeBron James is going to be with Nike. I'm going to get an internship. One intern a year, figured it out, learned, and ended up getting a job. I mean, it was just how he was able to parlay and leverage relationship and to learn the business as much as they could and build off of that, continue to build and understand and then get the trust factor of LeBron and understand the business. And so eventually LeBron can get out under what he was with his and start his own management to allow those guys to ascend even higher. And everybody has their own lane to do and to
yeah.
change the game. And I love him. I love LaVar Ball. I mean, it's certain guys who are just, I think, are just brilliant that if you allow the media to project an image, they're going to project the wrong image. And it's like my dad used to always tell me. He said, man, my dad caught hell in the media. And I was just, I was nowhere near these guys. But because they thought he was overbearing, he was domineering, he was all this, my dad said when Bob Ferry did it, it was okay. Right? And then when Peyton Manning's father did it, it was even better. See, we forget about, but that's okay for them. But for us, you cannot be a black father and be involved in your child's life. You got to, they never see that. They see black moms, don't know much about sports and love their son to death and here, let their father figure coach go and take them, and I got an agent for them, and I got this, and they got David Falk over here, and I got this one over there. Man, that's what it used to. That's it.
That's what it used to. That's true. I'm telling you.
So when LeVar Ball has changed the NBA forever. He's changed NCAA forever. He's changed high school forever. In a matter of 3 years, he's changed all three major industries in basketball forever, just like that. And they try to ridicule him and write him off.
All right, Gerard, I tell you, and I knew this was going to be quite an interesting, informative interview, but we've got 15 minutes left. So just talk briefly about your career in the NBA. As I mentioned earlier, you selected number 17th overall, first round. You go to the Mecca. You're talking about the Mecca of basketball, so to speak, New York City, and play for the Knicks, along with Patrick Ewing, Charles Oakley, Mo Cheeks. Boy, you know, there's some Hall of Famers and some big names there. Just briefly share with us that experience playing in Gotham and playing for the Knicks.
Okay. Interesting experience. I enjoyed New York, and New York grew on me. You know, I learned that basketball was definitely a business. You know, when I was in New York, very expensive, very. One thing my dad did is said, look, you on your own. He said, look, you go. I had to go there, find my own place. I knew nothing about New York City, the proximity of the practice facility to Madison Square Garden, to where I'm going to live at. I had to kind of figure out everything on my own. You know, and that was a lot to process as a young guy, but he allowed me to grow and to do those things. So I was able to do it. I leaned on Charles Oakley a lot because he was like a big brother type guy. You know, if he's with you, he's with you. And that's how he was. Everybody's not like that. Mo Cheeks was a great guy. Matter of fact, Mo Cheeks would talk to me a lot. We would switch cars up. He said, let me drive your car, you drive mine. You know, Mo would live in Philadelphia some half the season. And I don't know how you lived in Philly and played in New York. But anyway, I learned a lot of stuff about these guys. But it was just surreal for me, for him, not Patrick Ewing, for Mo Cheeks, because I remember my dad was a Dr. J fan. Dr. J was his man. He said that was his favorite player. He said his grace, his class, and all that. And so I remember watching Mo Cheeks being his point guard. And playing with Mo was like, wow, I'm playing with Mo Cheeks. You know what I mean? And so he actually likes me, which is even better. So Patrick Ewing is a Ewing that you know. He's probably he wasn't a tough guy you thought he was, I tell you that much. He wasn't the big bad wolf that you think he was. The enforcer, without a doubt, is Charles Oakley, but he was your guy, your big brother. He'd take you wherever you want. You go to his house, you eat with him, he cook for you. I mean, everything that you want, that's Charles Oakley. So I played with, you know, Mark Jackson was a great guy too, you know, but Mark had his own issues with the team at the time because you got Mark Jackson, you know, was a up and coming point guard, but then Mo Cheeks is kind of like the veteran. The crazy thing is I went through five coaches, man, in 4 years.
Yeah.
To me, it's like, you know, which is people don't understand that, but when you go on coaching and the coaching staff philosophies and all those other internal things will affect everybody, and it did affect a lot of players. You know, but New York was a place that I thought I could really grow and learn. I mean, those guys said, look, man, you need to get some new suits, right? And so I said, okay. So they gave me their tailors to get suits because I was going to Casual Male big and tall. You know, I was right in green belt, Casual Male big and tall, pick up something. They said, you don't wear that. And then Oakley said, hey, man, I don't wear the same suit twice in 1 year. I said, what? He said, no, I don't wear the same suit twice. So I'm like, wow. Man, that first check gone. It's gone.
just buy clothes. Yeah,
buy clothes, man. But nah, that was, man, took me to Sylvia's. That was our spot. Me and Oakley every day, we go to Sylvia's to eat. You know, you meet the celebrities, man. Whether it's Spike Lee, I mean, everybody, they come to see you, so you get to interact with them, which is different, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So New York is but I tell you what, man, the culture shock. And I never liked Ernie Grunfeld. He was the one guy that wanted to draft me, to work me out and all that. But it took me a long time to get over being traded. And the reason why it took me a long time, because I had talked to Ernie, man-to-man, face-to-face, and I probably heard 50 players say this after the fact, in the last, 20 years. He told me to my face, I will not be traded. I didn't understand that that's just what they do. They just tell you they lie. That's what basketball executives do. He sat there and said, no, you're going to be here forever. And a week later, I said, because I'm getting ready to get a house. That's what I told him. I said, look, man, I want to get a house because I'm paying this ridiculous rent up in White Plains. And so I went to him, and my lease was up after my first year. And, nope, you can be my man. And they called me in and said, oh, I was at the Garden picking up tickets to go see Luther Vandross. He was at the Garden that night. And they said, oh, you've been traded. You got to leave tomorrow. And I was in shock that tomorrow. And I'm like, this man just told me, and I didn't speak to Ernie until like 10 years or so. I happened to see him at BWI Airport when I was traveling one day. And I'm like, wow, it was just crazy that this guy told me that. But then like I said, you get older, you realize that's basketball. That's the business.
That's how they do business.
Even though it's not my business, that's their business.
That's right.
But we all go through it.
All
go through it. Charles Barkley, I watched A. Poland do Michael Jordan. So when you do that, it doesn't matter. Everybody goes through that, right?
That's right.
Yep, the culture shock for me was going to Phoenix. And I got to Phoenix October the 5th. It was during training camp, beginning training camp. It was 105 degrees when I got off the plane. October the 5th, 105 degrees. I go to the team headquarters. It's some little nondescript building. And I couldn't believe it was the headquarters, right? So you go in there, and I see Tom Chambers with cowboy boots on, and I'm like, what is this? Right? So I'm coming from New York City, from all the players. You know how it suits and overcoats and fair coats, and we go down there, and the first game we had, Coach, I'm going to tell you, I had on a suit, ready for the first game. They got on shorts, flip-flops, T-shirts.
Wow.
Kurt Rambis said, Moose, what are you doing? We don't wear that here. And I'm like, wow. They don't wear suits to games. They wore T-shirts, polo shirts, slides. Back then I called them flip-flops. And that's it. That's what you did to a game. Yeah. So the culture shock to me was, and we actually played our games in the Arizona Coliseum. It was the state fairgrounds. So it wasn't even an arena. And so we practiced in like an elementary, middle school. Think about that.
Yeah.
From New York City to Phoenix where we were at. Now, they built the new arena and the practice court and all that the year later. But when I got there, this was like a rinky-dink high school stuff that we were doing in Phoenix.
Wow.
So the culture shock was there, buddy.
Yeah. So, Gerard, man, we've got 3 minutes. I tell you, I knew this was going to be awesome, as you always are, but you are in rare form today.
Okay.
But let's use these last 2 minutes
and
a half or so to just briefly talk about the Take Charge Juvenile Division Program.
Yes, sir. So to give you the quick on it, when I was my father was a bailiff in the court system back in the late 80s, and he had saw so many young men come through the system that he wanted to see if he could allow the judge to give those young men to him instead of sending them to the boys' village so he can help redirect their lives, dress them up, clean them up, you know, just help them become men, like a boyhood and manhood, and have them take charge of themselves. So we weren't a nonprofit. It was just something he wanted to do. I was in the midst of announcing that I was going to go to the NBA. And so that summer I got drafted. He wanted to live out his dream, and I wanted to live out my dream. And so I said, okay, let's make it happen. And so he was allowed to, you know, leave the court system as a bailiff, and we started the Take Charge program. And, you know, this is 30 years we've been going, helping redirect, transform lives of young men, young women in Prince George's County, Washington, D.C.
Sure.
You know, and we've added leadership development. We've added STEAM.
Mm-hmm.
We've added for girls only programming. You know, we've added a lot of different pieces to it, but we've still been going strong. The only thing that has hindered us has been these last 2.5 months with this pandemic. But you know, but we're doing the best we can. We've added basketball to it for kids who wanted to use basketball as a vehicle to help them continue to grow and develop. So, you know, we've been doing it. We've been working.
All right. And you will continue to do it real quick.
Yes, sir.
Is there a number where people can contact you to find more about the Take Charge Juvenile Division Program? Real quick.
Yes, sir. Number is 301-420-7395. 301-420-7395.
Gerard Mustaf, awesome,
yes,
man.
Yes, sir.
This is a masterpiece. Appreciate you. Love you, man.
No, thank you. You too, Coach. Thank
support.
You, man. Listen, I'm going to call you. I want some more history from you, okay, Coach?
You got it, brother.
Yes,
thank
sir.
You.
All right. Thank you.
All
be
right,
safe.
Folks. That was Gerard Mustaf in the Coach's Corner on In and Out of Sports. Hope you enjoyed it. And, hey, next week we've got some more legends that have scheduled a visit in the Coach's Corner on In and Out of Sports. But for right now, we're out of time. I want to thank Hortons Field Service, Dr. Edward T. Buford, the Athletic Republic, Capital Region, and as always, this show is powered by the AfricanAmericanAthlete.com and my producer and founder of the AfricanAmericanAthlete.com, my main man, Rick Hampton Sr. So, folks, until next time, make good decisions because life is hard, but it's even harder when you're stupid.
You'll listen to a 30-second demo. Go premium to download the entire file.